Also, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signs SB 4 Show Me Your Papers law, and the National Day Labor Organizing Network takes on the governor head on. We're going to hear a lot about that as well. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints, and my name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine, and we are really happy to welcome back to these airwaves Professor Vijay Prashad. Professor Prashad actually was just a guest here in the Bay Area. He is a professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He's the author of some 18 books, including Arab Spring, Libyan Winter, also The Poor Nations, A Possible History of the Global South, and The Death of a Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. Well, Professor Prashad, I wish this was a happy day and there really was some kind of liberation to celebrate, but I've been studying the situation, reading your pieces, and the Prime Minister of Iraq calls it a liberation. How would you characterize what we're seeing and what we've seen unfold in Mosul? And welcome back, by the way.
Well, thanks a lot, Dennis. Nice to be with you again. So, Dennis, it's a complicated situation because, the city of Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq, a city of great history and character, had been under the control of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The group had taken Mosul about 2 and some years ago. It has taken 9 months of concerted fighting to remove the Islamic State group from Mosul. They have mostly been removed. In that respect, of course, it is liberation from the Islamic State. On the other side, this war for 9 months has been a war of very significant aerial bombardment and immense use of artillery fire. This aerial bombardment, of course, has come thanks to the United States Air Force, which has pummeled the city, particularly western Mosul, and destroyed very large parts of it. There are 1 million refugees out of Mosul. They are in 19 emergency camps. The United Nations says that they are struggling to have these 1 million people live everyday lives. The city has been utterly destroyed. It's very unlikely that it will be easy for the 1 million-plus people to return to their homes. But most strikingly, Dennis, the nature of the bombardment was so immensely brutal that it occurs to me that within either a year or perhaps 2 years, we're going to see the revival of something like the Islamic State group. After all, when the United States military destroyed Fallujah and Ramadi in 2004 and 2005, both cities in north central Iraq, at that point in its aftermath, the brutal destruction of those cities, the use of depleted uranium, the use perhaps of white phosphorus, that brutal destruction produced the Islamic State of Iraq, which was created in 2006. So it's likely that this very brutal form of warfare used to eject the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria from Mosul this time is not going to be the end of that group, but it will be, I think, the ground for its reemergence in a few years.
I think you refer to the group Air Wars and also Amnesty International about talking about the disproportionate use of weaponry, the extent of bombing of civilians. The Amnesty, I think you quote them, talk about the unnecessary killing of civilians in terms of overkill, if you will.
Well, this is a very important piece of the equation. In other words, yes, there are photographs across the internet which show the quite serious devastation in Mosul. And I think what has already begun to happen is that people in the, Western corporate media have started to indicate that this destruction was largely the cause of ISIS. Now, it's true that ISIS did, of course, destroy very many sites of historical importance in the city. But ISIS doesn't have the capacity for aerial bombardment. So much of the physical destruction of the city has taken place as a consequence largely of American aerial bombardment. Amnesty looked at a series of important bombing raids, and it concluded in a report that was published on the 11th of July, it concluded that there was needless loss of civilian lives and came to the point, Dennis, and I think this is very important, it came to the point of saying there were so-called unlawful attacks in Mosul. Now, the reaction from the United States military was swift, and Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend very quickly said that the United States rejects any notion that the coalition, in other words, the United States, targeted civilians. Well, what's very interesting about that statement, Dennis, from Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, is that a few days later, speaking about Raqqa, which is a city in northern Syria held by ISIS, just a few days after he said the United States doesn't target civilians, he told the New York Times that in Raqqa in Syria, the United States is bombing bridges to prevent civilians from fleeing the city, and in those bombing raids, civilians have been targeted. So now, on the one side, with Mosul, he said that the United States does not ever target civilians, and on the other side, speaking about Syria, very cavalierly, he says, yes, we've bombed those bridges, we don't want anybody to flee the city. In other words, we are trapping civilians. This is a war crime. We're trapping civilians in a city which we are now going to bomb, very aggressively in order to obliterate, to annihilate. That's the word that the United States has used, ISIS.
I believe the exact phrase the general uses, we shoot every boat we find. If you want to get out of Raqqa right now, you've got to build a poncho raft.
Yes. So this is, and I want to underline, this is Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, who is the very same spokesperson who said that the United States does not commit atrocities against civilians, is saying we're going to destroy every boat. So this was the Amnesty report on Mosul, and I think it should be taken very seriously. After Stephen Townsend made his claim that the United States doesn't commit war crimes, AWARS, a very important group which monitors aerial bombardment, showed that there has indeed been extensive bombing of civilian infrastructure in Mosul, and in Raqqa, including things like internet cafes, swimming pools, mosques, etc. The destruction of the civilian infrastructure, in a sense, creates despair among the population. This is a very serious allegation made by AWARS, and if it's true, it is very close to being a violation of the Geneva Convention. It is, of course, therefore, coming towards indicating that the United States is committing war crimes both in Mosul and in Raqqa in Syria.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're speaking with Vijay Prashad, and we're talking about what has been characterized by the Prime Minister of Iraq as the liberation of Mosul. And it is, as you say, there is a bit of a liberation there, but there is great suffering. And, well, maybe we could just step back a little bit, take a look at the Prime Minister, his role, and the U.S. role, the kind of policies that, as you say, might foster another ISIS in a couple of years.
Yeah, so, one of the things that I think American nationals should not forget is that the United States, in an illegal war in 2003, began to systematically destroy Iraq. I mean, this is really where the conversation should always begin. You know, it's very easy to begin these conversations, Dennis, about some pathologies in Islam, perhaps, you know, the classical so-called Islamophobic approach to these issues, or people throw their hands up and say, well, you know, it's that part of the world, they've always been fighting, nothing to do with us, look somewhere else. Well, the fact is that the author of this particular set of tragedies is, you know, is absolutely the illegal war perpetuated by George W. Bush's government in 2003. That war not only destroyed the Iraqi state, destroyed significant resources in Iraqi society, but it also destroyed agriculture and sent many farmers basically into deep distress. When there was an uprising against these policies in the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi in Anbar province, the United States at the time, its armed forces led by Jim Mattis, now the Secretary of Defense, was extraordinarily brutal in the crackdown. You know, there was use of depleted uranium, which has produced radiation in parts of Ramadi and Fallujah that are multiple times more than the radiation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it was in this immense destruction of Iraq and in the really targeted destruction of Fallujah and Ramadi that ISIS emerged in the first place. Now, when we see after this period, when, you know, the cities have been destroyed, and this exiled party, the Islamic Dawah Party, one of whose senior leaders was Mr. Abadi, when this group emerged in Iraq, you know, it began to be slowly sidelined. It was not taken seriously. The Iraqi people rejected it. And at this point, there was an attempt inside Iraq to create a kind of patriotic agenda. This agenda was fostered by civil society groups. They emerged in force in 2011. And at this time, there was a crackdown against this kind of peaceful emergence of the Iraqi people on a patriotic platform. When this crackdown occurred, many people were disillusioned with the Iraqi project and they went over to ISIS. This happened, for instance, in the town of Al-Hawija, where ISIS continues to be in control in northern Iraq. And so the harsh destruction of Iraq by the United States, combined with the current government's very sectarian politics as far as the people of Iraq are concerned, you know, this government's rejection of the people of Iraq's patriotic platform, which was put forward in 2011. You know, this is a combustible situation which gave energy to the resurfacing of ISIS in 2013 and 14. And the current war in Mosul and in Raqqa is not going to destroy ISIS because it is creating such immense civilian suffering. In this civilian suffering, in this crucible, unless there is a political project that, you know, integrates people into, say, Iraqi nationalism or some kind of Syrian nationalism, there's going to be the emergence of very extreme groups in the future. So this kind of harsh warfare, it very rarely results in a good outcome in our times. It has always produced something quite ugly.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Professor Vijay Prashad. He's a professor of international studies at Trinity College. He's the author of some 18 books and knows a great deal about what's happening in the region. And I think it's important just to talk a little bit of even a broader history of the United States in Iraq and in the region. U.S. policy towards Iraq, let's just take it from the cynical policy of the U.S. to support both sides in the Iraq-Iran war and sort of the policy is let them kill each other and we'll just move in and we'll take the resources. The kind of policy, the kind of wars that we have conducted, the kind of actions that have destroyed this ancient city, It's just the boycotts, the embargo that cost hundreds of thousands of children their lives. You talk about the depleted uranium, not just the soldiers, the people, the children. There are epidemics that stem from the impact of these this chemistry. We can even see it on the incredible numbers of soldiers that have come back from Iraq suffering from those same kinds of wounds from depleted uranium because the Army never told them what they were dealing with.
Yes, and depleted uranium is one piece of it, white phosphorus is another, and then there's just the normal level of munitions that are used. You know, much more volume of munitions used in Iraq than you can imagine used in other conflicts. You know, I was surprised to read the other day how more weapons were used against Vietnam in the Vietnam War than in the totality of World War II in all its theaters. And this includes the long Japanese war. I mean, it's a stunning volume of weapons used against these societies with absolute impunity. You know, no sense that there'll be censure from anybody. So, you know, one should not be surprised if the United States uses this kind of weaponry against people whose spirit gets broken and whose political project, you know, is rendered hopeless. It's no surprise that they turn to extremism. You know, let me give you a parallel example. You know, it's not that, for instance, the Palestinian people have not suffered great indignity, have been victims of, you know, the worst kind of occupation and oppression. But because there's a unifying political project, that unifying political project, which is the eventual creation of some sort of homeland for the Palestinians, has given that movement a very great maturity. And you don't see, you know, the kind of extremism that one would imagine. In other words, what I'm saying is that I would imagine after 60-odd years of the condition of the Palestinians that there would be near anarchy in Palestinian politics. But no, that is not what one sees. So it's not sufficient to have wretched conditions to lead you to extremist politics. It's